fiction from the contemporary South, next on Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for Readings, Conversation, and Music featuring writer Clyde Edgerton. We'll talk about his new novel, In Memory of Junior. Major funding for this program comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund, Incorporated.
I don't usually read about the colleges. I usually hit the front page and the docket and the sports and the funnies. But I was thumbing through and saw this thing about dead white males. And what it said was there's this group of feminists and abstractionists and destructionists or something over at Duke University who are trying to cut out everything that dead white males have ever done. I said to myself, wait a minute.
Writer Clyde Edgerton reading from his new novel, In Memory of Junior. In the reading you just heard, one of Edgerton's characters comments on academic life in the contemporary South. But on a more personal level, the voices that we hear in the novel tell the story of two families, the Bales and the McCords. When the book opens, as the patriarch and matriarch lay dying, the question is, who will inherit the family farm? Reading from his new novel, In Memory of Junior, and speaking in the voice of matriarch Laura Bales, here is Clyde Edgerton.
I open the box and look over the different shapes of chocolate. Whitman's Sampler, my very favorite. Yes, sir, my very favorite. I always was blessed with good neighbors. The first piece of warm chocolate candy is that boy Thason. I swallow him. The one always stuck his tongue out at me, cussed me even. I finger another little hunk of chocolate with a nut of some sort in it, I bet. I eat it. Oh, it's got a crunch. It's that Grove McCord. And who? Harold said he heard he's coming back here to die. Somebody heard it. Nobody wants him back here. I eat that other boy, Tate, that ran from me. Wouldn't mind a thing I said. A lumpy piece. Evelyn. The one that left Glenn. I eat her. She deserted those boys. Now, that awful Grove, Evelyn's brother. Did I just eat him? I'll eat him again. This is good candy. My very favorite. I do wish I wasn't sick, but I love my candy.
Clyde Edgerton, I congratulate you on these wonderful characters that you have created in this novel, In Memory of Junior. We just heard the voice of, we got Glenn Bales and we got his wife, Laura. These are two people who are dying. You're asking a question after a fashion, Clyde. That is to say, what is a family? How does it all sort of hang together? Is that too crude? I mean, was that going through your mind when you wrote this novel?
I think it went through my mind more after I finished reading the novel and someone mentioned it than it did while I was writing the novel. I can see now, looking back, that there are relationships in this book among people who aren't blood family. Uh-huh. But the relationships are such that they are very powerful, like family relationships. They're stepchildren here. Especially stepchildren.
Well, that goes to your title, In Memory of Junior. Here we've got Thason, who is the stepfather of Junior, who is a little boy who's dead by the time the book opens, and his real daddy is John Moody. And what's going on between Thason and Junior and Thason's second wife, June? Good. I mean, you got to have a genealogical chart here in front of you. In fact, I do.
Right. that helps. And, you know, I always, when I see those things, it shies me away from the book. But I but I felt that it would be helpful because all these different characters are speaking, and I thought it would be nice to be able to thumb back and look clearly and see what the relationships are. Because in most families, if you talk about more than four or five or six people, it does begin to get complicated.
Well, what about this little boy, Junior? I mean, his name is in the title of the book, and yet he's not really in the book.
Right, he's not. And I have to go back and talk about the short story, which was the genesis of this novel, and how that arose. And that came about as a consequence, in part, of my seeing a car fly through an intersection in front of me. I was at a stoplight.
You told me about this last time you were on this radio program, as a matter of fact.
And that story stayed with me. The image of her coming through the intersection, the little boy in the back seat, leaning up on the, holding onto the front seat. I could see dirt rings around his neck. And this image was powerful enough for some reason that I wrote it down and kept remembering it. And that image, along with several others, caused a short story called Changing Names. And with the first short story, this is before the book was written, with the first short story, Junior's death served as a topic of conversation among several people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as the book developed, that part, that initial part of that story needed to stay in the book. So, and from Junior's death, the story began to evolve. And of course, I didn't want to go back in time, so Junior had to stay dead. But near the end of the book, I realized that this boy's perspective, what he might have said about his life, was important. So I had to come up with a device. I had to come up with a technique. So I just uncovered a journal.
And you let him speak to us from the grave. And
then there were three or four other short stories which followed in the next year. And I saw suddenly one day that they belonged to the same family, to the same novel. And so then I started structuring the novel.
Well, the thing that struck me about the book is part of what you're doing here as a writer, that is to say the technique that you bring to In Memory of Junior. We have a series of voices. We really don't have a narrative in any conventional sense, and it's on these, we depend on these voices to figure out, well, now, wait a minute, is he talking about her, and is she talking about him? All of these genealogical lines that you're drawing.
Right, and that was an accident of sorts. I started out wanting to write the book from one point of view, from an omniscient point of view, and maintain authorial control and be able to write my own views and points of view and to set it up, and I tried it that way. And Lewis Rubin, who is, or was until recently, my publisher, he's retired now, read the book in draft form and planted the seed. He suggested that the book be told by characters, individual voices, not unlike my third novel. And I didn't like that suggestion because I wanted to be the author. I didn't want these characters to be writing the book. But then I noticed when someone would start in this book, would start talking for a good period of time, and I would turn that character loose, that story, that narrative had a strength that was lacking. So I began to experiment, and I had many stories that my real Uncle Bob had told me that I had transcribed from tape. But I believe that storytelling is a force against death. I believe death is the enemy. And stories live, and some stories do not die, and death cannot reach some stories. So, in a sense, stories are running neck and neck with death, and as art is, and stories are the same, so art is fighting death. So in a very broad sense, stories kind of laugh at death in a way, I think. And Mark Twain, of course, said that no enemy can withstand laughter. We're all, of course, going to die. There, as Harry Crewe says, there have yet to be any exceptions. And I take also personal courage from my family. And most of my, I was born to parents who were quite old, and my mother's now 88. And the people who are left in the family, many of my, I had 23 aunts and uncles, and only a few are left. Most of them have
just,
died.
Just a couple of more characters than you've got in this book.
Right. Most of these people have died in the real world in the last 10 or 15 years. Uh-huh. So in that way, I've lost people who were close to me and my family. But my
this
mother,
is a way for you to talk to them after
maybe
a fashion.
So. My mother and my aunts have had and do have a kind of shall we say sense of humor about talking about death and about.
Do you think of them as literary critics, Clyde? I mean, do you go to them and try your ideas and your characters out on them?
My mother reads everything I write before it's published, before I give it to the publisher, and we have interesting conversations that we would have never had.
Good for you.
if I hadn't chose not to let her read my fiction. Yeah. Before it was published. So we have good conversations.
Let me bring you back to a couple of the characters that you've got in this book. One of them is a character named Evelyn. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag here and spoil the story for people who haven't read your book, In Memory of Junior. But let's say that here we have a sort of gender component, a sexual dimension to your fiction that wasn't really there before, at least not as emphatic. Mm-hmm. Did you do this to shock us? Did you put something on the page about, again, I don't want to spoil the, sure. the story, but what happens to Evelyn and her children? That's pretty new to your stuff.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, when you ask the question, I usually think of what was the source? What was the source of Evelyn? What was the source of where did that come from, and how did I approach it? And actually, I heard a story. Much of what I end up getting in my novels comes from stories I've heard. Sure. And stories that have struck me and I've hung on to. And the story was told to me by an aunt about a love affair. And she did not use the term love affair, but she described this relationship yeah. in such mm-hmm. a way that I knew what she was talking about, and I wrote that down and remembered it. And then I needed a reason for the main character's mother to have left them when they were small. I just needed a reason, so out of the bag I pulled this story and stuck it on their mother. And made it seem real.
Well, what you're doing is you're inviting us to look at Southerners not only in terms of, you know, the stereotypes, the weird, the semi-weird, the completely weird, the grotesque. You're inviting us to look at them as, well, now, wait a minute, there are people down the street in my neighborhood like that, and they aren't so strange after all, are they?
Well, I think that's right, and I hope that's right. And one critic recently, I read a review somewhere complaining about Southern characters or the grotesqueness in the characters. And Flannery O'Connor said, even though it was a while back, that the only reason that Southern literature has the grotesque in it is that you can tell who's grotesque and who's not in the South. And she was, I think, implying that in some places in the country, it's all run together now.
Do you have a favorite character of all of these wonderful voices that you have created in Memory of Junior?
I would have to say, if I had to pick between all those characters, I would have to end up with Grove McCord and Gloria Palmer. I would have to end up with those two people if I had to throw all away except two.
Oh, there's your affection for Faulkner coming through, I take it. You've got the voice of this elderly black woman, and she's one of the coherent, cohesive characters here, is she not?
She is coherent. She
makes it all hang together.
And she's an observer uh-huh. also, which makes it makes her need to be that way from a technical point of view. From my point of view, she needs to be that way because she's watching what's going on.
This is the one who says, wait a minute, that stretch of I-40 shouldn't be named for Michael Jordan.
Right.
But tell me that story quickly.
Well, she's very upset because of the year she spent taking care of her husband, and she's seeing this woman, Miss Laura, also taking care of her husband. And she, it suddenly, with startling insight, realizes that if the highway is going to be named after someone, it should be named after someone who has struggled for years doing something they did not want to do but did out of love, whereas someone like Michael Jordan...
This isn't an attack on Michael Jordan.
No, it's not. But someone like Michael Jordan, for example, he's a hero because he's the one who he's been having fun, and he gets lauded and credit for having a good time and making a lot of money, whereas someone like her who struggled gets no credit, and she thought that was maybe a reverse of what it should be.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week is writer Clyde Edgerton. In just a moment, we'll get back to talking about his new novel, In Memory of Junior. First, some of Clyde Edgerton's music. I asked him to explain.
This is just the first and last verse of a little song that I've written and that several of us have recorded for Lee Smith's book, The Devil's Dream. And the song, the title was in the book without a song. It was given by Annie Dillard. The title is Two Lefts Don't Make a Right. And I wrote the song to try to figure out what that meant. And here a couple of verses or a little piece of it. You knock down the refrigerator, I knock down the door. The Airstream tires are now all flat, we don't live here no more. I just dropped by to look around, it's our anniversary night. I might be drunk, but this I know, two lefts don't make a right. You left, I left, but two lefts don't make a right. Why couldn't we just sit and talk, why did we stand and fight? You took the dog, I took the cat on that fateful night. Sometimes I wish I'd got the dog, two lefts don't make a right. You went home to mama, I went home to dad. The dog pen still stands out back and empty, it looks sad. He was a blue tick hound dog, mostly black and white. You know I loved you more than him, two lefts don't make a right. You left, I left, but two lefts don't make a right. Why couldn't we just sit and talk? Why did we stand and fight? You took the dog, I took the cat on that fateful night. Now I wish I'd got the dog, two lefts don't make a right. I'll trade you the cat for the dog, two lefts don't make a right. Then maybe we can try it again, two lefts don't make a right.
Social worker from Boston on a trip to Carolina stopped in Apex for Beaujolais wine. 'Twas a hasty decision, but she liked the little town. She married the mayor and settled down. She's a quiche woman in a barbecue town. There's trucks and ticks and tobacco all around. She was Vassar cum laude several years ago. The adjustment will be slow. Her next-door neighbor, Mrs. Billy Ray Birch, shackled and chained her and dragged her to church. She found the town council related and the local swimming pool segregated. She's a quiche woman in a barbecue town. There's trucks and ticks and tobacco all around. She was Vassar cum laude several years ago. The adjustment will be slow. Like to hunt quail, deer, duck, and the little cottontail. Said she, where you been? What's the reason? Said he,
where you think? It's hunting season.
She's a quiche woman in a barbecue town. There's trucks and ticks and tobacco all around. She was Vassar cum laude several years ago. The adjustment will be slow.
Taught her to hunt, to plow and fish, and chew tobacco once a month. Things worked together for the good of hear tell she went to school at Cornell. She's a barbecue woman in a Keystown and city slickers and Yankees and bankers all around. She just left Apex several days ago. The adjustment will be slow. She's a barbecue woman in a Keystown city slickers and Yankees and bankers all around. She just left Apex several days ago. The adjustment will be slow. The adjustment will be slow.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. You just heard the Tarwater Band, the music of Clyde Edgerton and friends. Back now to my conversation with Clyde Edgerton. We're talking about his new novel, In Memory of Junior. Clyde, do you carry words like memory and history around in your mind? Do they weigh heavily on you when you create stories like you have here, and such as the one you have here in Memory of Junior?
No. In fact, I work against that. I work against having any abstract terms in my mind while I'm writing, and I work on what I want a reader to see that is happening in the story. And by see, I guess I mean hear also.
Uh-huh.
So that when I write, I'm trying to recreate a real situation. And I know that I'm writing about memory and I'm writing about history in ways, but I after the fact, I might play with those thoughts a little bit, looking back at a book I've written and think about how it might do something.
Mm-hmm.
For a reader or for me as a reader, but usually I'm by that time working on another novel.
Well, let's pause on that for a moment. Do you want to change your readers? I mean, what happens to your fiction once it's let loose and it's out there in the public? Does it concern you, or how do you think about what you're doing to all these people reading these books?
What I think about, I believe, is what I would like to read. I think I write for myself as a reader. I see myself as an ideal reader because I'm the one person I know best. And for me to think about audience, I believe would be a mistake because of what I'm trying to do. If I were trying to sell a product, it would be important, a certain product, for me to think about audience. But I'm trying to recreate or create something which seems to recreate life in a way. And so I have to satisfy myself first.
Clyde Edgerton, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Would you read to me again from your new novel, In Memory of Junior? Set this one up for me.
Sure. The speaker is Grove McCord. He's viewing his gravesite. His nephews have taken him to his grave. He's looking at it to decide how he likes it, and he gets off into a story. And the story at this point is that a dog he very much dislikes, a little poodle, has died in a station wagon.
Oh my goodness.
And he and the poodle's owner are standing outside in the rain, and the poodle's owner is holding the dog, trying to get Grove to bring him back to life with mouth to mouth, which Grove is known to be able to do with a dog. He's brought a bird dog back to life before, and all the kids are screaming and looking out the station wagon window, and Grove will take up in the middle of this, and Grove says this:
I don't take the dog. The rain starts picking up, and the dog is good and dead and wet. Used to be fluffy. And I said, "You can do it as easy as I can." And the kids are pressed up against the window and screaming and crying, and noses all mashed in against the glass. And Don says, "I ain't gonna do it. See, I'm glad the dog is dead." So he gets the dog up in his arms and cradles him like a baby, you know, and tries to figure out how to do it. I said, "Just hold his mouth closed and puff through that little wet nose and then back off and then puff and then back off." And he did. And the dog would puff all up and then go down. Puff all up and then go down. Right off in, 8 to 10 seconds, the damn dog kicks and jerks, and there he is, good as ever, squirming around trying to get down. Worrisome little rascal. Don was right proud of himself.
Well, Clyde, I want to congratulate you on these wonderful voices that you create. Your book is In Memory of Junior, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Give me 30 seconds here. Tell me quickly, what are you working on now?
Thanks a lot, Wayne. It's always fun to be here. I appreciate your asking me. I'm working on a book placed in the Southwest in the late 1800s. One of the main characters will be a freelance embalmer.
A freelance embalmer?
Yes, from North Carolina. That's how I keep it connected to the other stuff.
Does it have a title yet?
No, okay. It doesn't.
Well, we'll look for this, what, another year or so down the road?
I hope in another year or two.
All right. Clyde, it's a pleasure to see you at the Humanities Center. Again, your book, In Memory of Junior, Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Thanks for coming by.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Soundings, a weekly magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guest was Clyde Edgerton, whose new novel, In Memory of Junior, is available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 642. That's program number 642, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, public critic, public poet. Morris Dickstein of the City University of New York will be here to discuss his new book, Double Agent, The Critic and Society. You'll also hear from Linda Gregerson of the University of Michigan. She'll read and talk about her award-winning poem, Line Drive, Caught by the Grace of God. Major funding for this program came from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional support from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, Carolina Power and Light Company, the Neutrogena Corporation, and the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Memory of Junior, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for readings, discussion, and music featuring writer Clyde Edgerton. We'll talk about his latest book, In Memory of Junior, a tale of love, loyalty, and families in the contemporary South. In Memory of Junior, the fiction and music of Clyde Edgerton, this week on Soundings.